Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Well, welcome everybody. This is a live edition of The Main Course. I am Patrick Martins, your host. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street, Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joe, are you awake?
I'm here.
Are you asleep yet with this introduction, with my long-winded introduction? Well, I'm watching someone eat the Roberta's Pizza the Bee Sting. I mean, I know I'm supposed to support local, but God, what are those honeys pollinating? I mean, it's like those honeys, like these bees got loose in Red Hook and they broke into the maraschino cherry factory. And so all the honey came out red. Like, we have to be careful where these bees are going. I mean, under the BQE, I don't know. But I know I love people bringing bees in, but I always wonder if it's like the best honey. All right. Well, now that I'm off the honey kick and what I see out the window of our shipping container, we are going to have a very good show today. We are in studio with Brett Macris. Welcome, Brett.
Hi, thanks.
And Brett's wife, Becky Brooks Macris. Mm-hmm. Thank you for hello.
She's waving.
She might say some things. But, you know, we started, you know, I came up with the introduction to this show, and I was looking, oh, okay, well, he's the chef of Rosewater. I want to talk about the menu and the concept and the challenges and what's it like cooking in Park Slope. And we're going to talk a little bit about the history of Campanile. And so, you know, it was a regular kind of outline. And then we were sitting here in the studio, and I found out that maybe I should reorganize and put the stuff at the bottom first, because Brett is, besides just a chef, a kind of a political movement, a one-man political movement, or, you know, with Becky, they are a two-person political movement. So you just got back from the Monsanto rally in Union Square, right?
Yeah, it was in Union Square, and, you know, the internet's an amazing thing, and managed to organize a large mass. I think it's a worldwide count is a little over 2 million people. Something like 58 cities, something like that, worldwide.
Wow, so they all met on yesterday?
Yeah.
The same time, and what were they protesting?
No, it was a different time. I mean, obviously different times, different time zones. So,
okay, right.
For us, it would have been the day before is when it started, but for them it was the 25th. But,
yeah. So what angers you about Monsanto? What drew you to this rally? Because you're a chef at Rosewater.
I am. I think that comes... Honestly, that comes first. I mean, for me, my problem with Monsanto, aside from the numerous problems I have with Monsanto genetic engineering, and don't get me wrong, I really don't have a problem with, in theory, with GMO. In theory, GMO could, for all intents and purposes, you could feed the world twice over. You could grow food in barren areas and feed people year-round with the concept.
But Bill Gates is behind it for that reason.
Yeah, he is. He's behind it for that reason. I think it's, you know,
but
right now...
But where does it go wrong?
It's a super untested science right now. And it's difficult because, you know, the way science works is you come up with an idea, you test that idea, then you put it out and other people test it and it comes back to you. It's scientific method. There's no scientific method here because it's Monsanto. You know, we were talking.
It's a privately held company,
you know, which now privately holds many of our politicians with, you know, money and votes and that sort of thing.
Plus, they have a terrible track record,
right?
It's not like they're stellar all the way through. Orange, and I don't even know these other things that came after that, but where they kind of knowingly did things, you know, or as you say, you know, didn't do the full research.
Yeah.
People start getting cancer and stuff. Their hair falls out.
And like I was going to say before, it's like my biggest problem is that, you know, I'm a chef and people come in and they eat the food. And it's my responsibility to make sure that they, when they leave healthy. Mm-hmm. And not worried that they're going to go home and be sick, or they're not going to go home and in 5 years end up with cancer, you know, unknowingly. So,
and then they also build everything that you keep needing more of their stuff. So you deal with their one problem develops because of one of their seeds, and then you have to buy a new pesticide to kill that seed. And
then
when that pesticide hurts the soil, you need to buy this new substance that's going to revive the soil.
Right.
All from them. And of course, they're greedy. They're looking at short-term profits. They're not looking at the long-term health of the soil.
Not at all. Not at all. They really are. I mean, it's the only testing done is by Monsanto. It's sent to the FDA, and the FDA looks at the results and goes, okay, great, and then they approve it. Mm-hmm. And so now you have a seed that, with really no long-term testing done on it, that could do multiple things. I mean, some of the immediate things that you see is that children become resistant to antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They've been eating cornflakes, or they've been eating cereals, or they've been eating General Mills products for most of their life, and suddenly they've been eating a corn strain that was bred to be resistant to antibiotics, and now you're resistant to antibiotics.
Yeah. And very interesting. I mean, yeah, they have the antibiotic thing, and then, you know, a guy like Will Perdue, or not, what's his, Frank Perdue, is like, we don't put any hormones. And I'm like, dude, what about the antibiotics in the feed? You know, you really have to consider that. And also, why do the animals need medicine in the first place?
Right.
Can't they survive? I mean, imagine doing that to our newborn children.
Right.
Just being like, hey, listen, it could get sick. I know it's only 2 days old. I want a steady dose of antibiotics in the milk. I mean, it's insane.
I mean, you do that as a commercial producer of meat, you do that because you want the animal to get fat quick, large quick, and you don't want any complications on the way, so you fill it full of hormone, you fill it full of antibiotic, it gets big quick, it goes to slaughter, you have an animal on the dinner table within a year.
So these weren't the first rallies that you went to. I mean, you, again, you're a chef first, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but since we're on this kick, you're into video games, technology, comics, but you're a real animal rights activist, so it's not just the GMO feed, it's also animal rights. Talk about your work with pit bulls and doing work with the local animal sanctuaries.
Yeah, we've been, you know, since our first pit bull, when we were in Los Angeles, we didn't even know she was really a pit bull until later it occurred to us. But
she told you?
Yeah, she told us. I don't think it was her that told us. It was probably somebody we were walking down the street, and you get looks. I mean, it's either get looks, you get fear, you get, and it's just a dog, man. You know, until it does otherwise, it's a dog. And you get a lot of people that don't agree. Luckily, there's a lot of support, but we do.
Do you do about it?
I post a lot. Social media I use like crazy. You can ask anybody who follows me. I'm crazy about pit bulls, and everybody who's listening who is nodding their head right now going, yes, he's crazy. But we've rescued dogs from the Brooklyn Animal Shelter. You know, every night I get a listing, a posting of dogs that are on the kill list. 90% of them are pit bulls. 95% of them are all pit bulls. You know, unfortunately, there are many, many people, and they end up there because of nefarious deeds, breeding them for fighting. You know, most people don't realize is that even the dogs that are bred for fighting don't want to fight. It's very rare you find a pit bull that actually wants to fight.
Can you bring them back once they're at that level? Do you worry about being attacked? If they were a fighting dog, for instance?
You know what? You can go to groups like Bad Rap. I mean, the one that comes first to mind is the Vic, Michael Vic. Almost every single dog was rehabilitated. Okay. Not all of them. A small percentage of them stay on farms now, animal farms. But most of those dogs were rehabilitated. And those dogs had been through hell. I mean, they had been beaten up. Many of them fought. I think they only had to put down four or five of the dogs, and I might be wrong. Mm-hmm. Two of them for aggression, and two or three of them just for health reasons.
Okay.
So they can be rehabilitated. Okay. You can just watch an episode of Caesar Milan, and you can watch him rehabilitate mm-hmm. old fighting dogs all the time. I mean, it happens. They recover a lot quicker than we do.
Even. So when you get this listing every day, I mean, I know Becky was saying that you guys will go to the pounds and walk the dogs around the block and to the parks just so that they can get some exercise. Is that what you do with them when you see them on the list?
When you see them, that's more complicated. The dogs on the list that I get, those are dogs that are, and it's urgent. It's called urgent on Facebook. And the reason it's called urgent is because these dogs are going to be put down sometimes at any moment, generally the next day. That's a little more complicated to get to those dogs because
they are... It's like being on death row.
It's so we tend to stay to groups like Sean Casey, and everybody should go see Sean Casey. He does amazing work, but he's kind of in Kensington.
And what is that? What do they do?
They rescue all kinds of animals. They rescue pythons to iguanas to cats to turtles to chickens in people's basements. But they do have a lot of... They also have a little pet store next door. They're working on a second location. But they adopt out and go through a lot of trouble to protect animals and pit bulls. And mm-hmm. and we love them.
And you have a blind wolf hound dog, right?
Yeah, Jack. He's... we've had him for almost 10 years. He just recently, in the last 2 years, got diabetes. So
he's, is that how he lost his sight?
Yeah, that's how he lost his sight.
So, yeah, and then also, you know, if there's a moment, like you say, you get these emails, and then, you know, you try to, you know, help or set the word or just understand what's happening with the whole pit bull movement. I mean, you also reacted to Hurricane Sandy, right? I mean, you had mentioned that. What exactly did you guys organize with the local farms to help people in the Rockaways?
Well, we had, like everybody, in New York City, it affected everybody. And for us, like, we feed people. That's what we do. You know, I don't know how to fix a... I can't restore electricity to a neighborhood, but I can cook.
I can cook, damn it!
And I have the resources and the means to get a lot of food to a lot of people. It's what I've been doing for many, many years. So I got together and emailed everybody, called people, those who, you know, anybody who I thought would help, could help. I put a thing on Facebook. People donated money to us. And I had farmers come, and Guy Jones in particular from Blooming Hill Farm donated twice a week sometimes a ton of food. Hmm. The people,
stuff he couldn't sell? Or
no.
No, he just...
No, came. No. He just said, whatever you want. Look on the list. He faxes a list to me every week. This is how I do my ordering from him. I circle the things I want. I call him back and tell him what I want, or I fax it to him either way. And then he drops it off the next morning at like 5 a.m. And every week he'd say, "You still doing it?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And he would say, "All right, well, what do you want?" And I would humbly say, "You know, look, whatever you want to give me, you know, I know he's just a farmer. Like, whatever you want to give me whatever you want." Okay, and I would come in the next day to come pick it up, and I'd have 10, 12 cases of everything from greens to mm-hmm. turnips, potatoes. He would donate everything he possibly could. Kale, everything. Yeah.
Well, then we would come up with different recipes. Like, we had a giant stock pot that fit on all four of our burners. And we have two kitchens in our apartment, so it kind of was helpful. And friends of ours from Plow came and helped out. And friends would come and prep every day. And then we would pack up cars full of people. Whatever produce we got, we just figured out what we would make. And then we would just... like guerrilla style, just go set up
where the boardwalk used to be or something like that.
We would go more like into, because there was like Occupy Sandy and all these other people, and they were like at designated locations. We were going to places where people weren't being reached, where you'd have to walk up like 40 flights of stairs or whatever, but we would go, you know, in the middle of the projects in Coney Island or out to Long Beach or where there wasn't, you know, where people were getting supplies but not necessarily food that we can pack up and take with them, you know, hearty soups, hot dishes, because it was getting cold that time of year.
Yeah, we had, I mean, we had amazing outpour of support. And we didn't, I mean, we were planning on just, like, if we had to, we were just going to drain the bank account and do it. And but luckily, we didn't have to because the support was amazing. And we would do it every day. I'd leave work, you know, Saturday night. I would get done with work, for example. I'd be home by, you know, 12:30. I'd be up until 4 or 5 o'clock cooking food. We'd 8 a.m., we'd load up the truck, load up the car, get the friends together, and go down and literally just find a corner and set up a table, and people would come. People who needed it. And,
Your good deed led to another good deed, right? Or, I mean, your good deed got rewarded because now you have a new project that kind of developed coincidentally out of that, and it's a new bar with food that you're both are opening up?
Yeah. We actually were signing a lease hopefully this week, fingers crossed. And
it's 5th Street between 20th and 21st?
Yeah.
So it was at Sunset Park, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, we
that's what the old timers say.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what the old
timers Now it's say. Known as Manhattan South.
Yeah. Yeah. Greenwood Heights.
Greenwood Heights, South Slope, you know, whatever. But yeah, it's going to be a bar. We love bar food. And again, obviously, if you know Rosewater, if you know what I do local food. I do, you know, mostly try to do farm to table as much as possible. And we're going to focus on New York. So everything on tap is going to be a New York bar. We're going to use as much New York booze as possible.
Yeah, there's gin companies, right? Sure, there's a winery in Red Oak.
There's bourbon.
There's many beers.
Yeah, gin, vodka, bourbon. I mean, they're everywhere. So, well, obviously we'll have, you know, a few of the, you know, regular ones. Anything in a bottle is probably will be, you know, available from everywhere. But, you know, for the most part, it's going to be all local stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about Rosewater. I mean, what's the menu, the concept? Who are your purveyors there that you support?
Well, you for one.
Right. Thank you, Heritage Foods.
Yeah, brings me half a pig every other week.
Yes, and thank you so much for that
sometimes
purchase.
Sometimes a goat, sometimes a lamb.
That's not why you were asked to be a guest today. You were actually a legitimate chef and very interesting guy.
But yeah, Rosewater started by John Tucker, geez, 13 years ago.
Wow, 13 years, same spot, huh?
Yeah, and it, you know, has grown to be a staple in Park Slope, you know.
Well, that goes way back even pre-Franny's, right? And pre-diner almost and all that. That's very impressive.
You know, he likes to say, you know, when I opened up, you couldn't go below 4th Avenue. Like, I couldn't below 5th Avenue, you know. Like, it just wasn't safe. We just didn't walk down there.
Now, where's Al Dila? That might be about 13 years, right?
Yeah,
they're neck and neck. Anyway, very pioneering. Yeah.
But, you know, he had a concept. He wanted to do sustainable. He wanted to do local before everybody else was doing it.
And the farmers were like, what? Deliver where? But and so now it's very successful. And what? How many seats is it? Tell our listeners and...
It's about like 35 inside and 16 outside for the covered patio.
It's tiny.
And it's traditional seasonal things, and you support various purveyors.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Guy Jones is one of them. I actually, and it's something I've started to get pretty excited about. You'll find more and more it's moving to an online ordering system, an online group. But what's nice is now I have farmers that are like we met Plow. Spelled with a V, Plovgu.
It's a Gaelic or something?
Yeah, they're sort
like
of the middleman.
All those silent letters.
Yeah, you go in and you go on their site, and they have a list of what's available from the farmers, and you pick it, and it shows up in the next couple of days. It's pretty awesome.
And so have the slow producers, the good, clean, and fair producers, have they gotten on board with what it takes to deliver successfully and consistently to a restaurant business like yours?
It's, you know, you deal with farmers, it's a little different than dealing with, you know, the
Sysco
Key Foods, or Sysco. You know, it's like you don't generally have the quality is not always as you want, but you have to deal with that, and you have to learn to work around it, and accept that the human element is very much there. So
because it's them themselves, but it's, I mean, them still themselves. Though, if it's ever going to take off as a movement, it has to start getting on
it
that
has
level,
to get
right?
there. And I think
you're
that's
nice,
what,
but when they start to do a public school or
right.
they can't be like, sorry,
the greens are yellow. Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. But I think things like plow, things like being able to go on and having a middleman helps them immensely, because then there is a little bit more quality control. There's a, you know, you can count on deliveries being there on time. You can, mm-hmm. you know, it's getting much better than how it used to be, where it's like I used to sometimes get a call at 6 o'clock in the morning. Sorry, the lamb's not on the truck.
Right.
Like, ah, great.
Now, how do you compare the kind of slow farm movement here in New York versus L.A. when you were both at Campanile? Is it on par, or are we behind?
It's different.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, I haven't been in L.A. for 5 years, and so I haven't had to deal with it. But everything about growing in agriculture is different in Los Angeles. It's a completely different ballgame. I mean, you can go to the farmer's market, you can get a strawberry in January, and it's good. Hmm. Whereas, I don't know why you would want to eat a strawberry in January, but...
you can still get it.
You can get it, and it's good, and it's grown. Right. It grew by itself.
Ojai in the south, I mean, yeah, it's just vibrant there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Green.
Yeah, it has, like, the climate of Italy. Yes. There's
like
things
central,
in season
central
all year round.
Central Southern California, it's the agriculture. You know, everything grows all the time. Like, it's... The seasons are very blurry. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, obviously, like sometimes you get a massive amount of tomatoes,
mm-hmm.
but you find tomatoes February
right,
at the farmer's market. No,
we can just say this: it's more challenging in a place like New York with seasons.
Yeah. doing what the, sort of the ideas that we do, seasonal and local and all that. It was a real challenge for me coming from. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles to coming here, because it's like, well, where are the avocados? When the avocados come in season? And they go, what are you talking about? Avocados? I'm like, no, we don't get avocados. Like, come on. You have to have an avocado tree somewhere. Like, no, that doesn't happen.
That's Ojai. They're really big into avocados. Yeah. They have like so many varieties of them too.
Yeah.
So Campanile, were you getting foods from small farms? I mean, LA's a little different.
Well, like, Campanile was one of the... Again, a pioneer in farm to table at the time. I mean, they were around for 23 years.
Mark Peel and Nancy Silverton opened it, right?
Yes,
and then she went on.
Yeah,
they divorced, and then Mark kept running it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
so tell us about the lore of Campanile. I'm sure, Joe, has anyone talked about Campanile on radio before?
I can't say. After working at this radio station for a little over a year, I've never heard of it on the radio.
Yeah, and it's a very legendary place, but this is such a New York-centric station that just doesn't come up as much.
Yeah, well, Mark Peel was, in his early days, he worked with Wolfgang Puck. He was a chef de cuisine at Spago when it opened. He worked with Alice Waters. Mm-hmm. I think that's where he got the bug for local farms. But, you know, they pioneered that. In L.A., they were huge for it.
And it was a big restaurant, right?
It was huge. Yeah, it was
like
the
looked like you were
the
in
building.
A Roman villa or something.
Yeah, and we talk about it in the past tense because it just recently closed just a few months ago after 23-something years. But, it, you know, obviously it holds a place in my heart. But because I was there for 7 years, and I was chef de cuisine for 3.
Hmm.
And but you learn, you know, and a massive amount of what it means to get to know a farmer, to get to know how they... I mean, I make it sound like it's L.A. farming is easy. It's not. They have the same problems, the same trials. They have the same, you know, it's just all pretty much the same things, but they have a lot more availability of what they sell.
Obviously. Highway 5 could be closed or...
Yeah,
229.
Of course.
I can't do the L.A. accent, but there's a lot of driving around there. I mean, imagine farmers must be on the road a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we got most of our stuff from the farmers at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Right, which is really one of the best.
It's one of the best. It's one of the biggest. But, I mean, Los Angeles, there's farmers market everywhere. I mean, you have to sort of wade through, you know, the pony rides and the kettle corn, but they're there. There's definitely farmers there on every day of the week. You can find a farmer's market within 10 miles of you.
So what was Campanelli then? You were just, it was an American restaurant, right? So you were doing fish and...
Yeah, they called it, Mediterranean, California Mediterranean.
California Mediterranean.
Yeah. Actually, by the time I was done, I was getting pigs from you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, but I was also getting stuff from,
local farms.
Oh, yeah. Local farms. Our fish came from this Japanese fish market in downtown, and
So I was trying to rate the top 10 terroirs because I'm always so disgusted and sickened by top 10 lists.
Yeah,
I'm like, how are they not the same every year? If you're talking about the 10 best cafes, shouldn't 9 or 8 of the 10 be the same every year?
Yeah.
Unless they close or do something terrible. Michelin, they do good. It's at least it's consistent. But I was thinking of the top 10 terroirs, and that if America were to ever, really grow to the food level of like Italy or France, it would need to see itself as a gastronomic mosaic where certain areas and Napa Valley was certainly in the top 2 or 3, and then Ojai was in the top 10 for what it could do. And then the Willamette Valley in Portland, kind of area, into Eugene. That West Coast is just like something about the Pacific, I guess, or I don't know what, but it is just like the nicest climate maybe on the planet.
It's perfect for growing anything you want to grow.
And then those valleys that I'm not even mentioning, I think they feed everybody.
They do. Feed everybody. I can't even do the percentage, but it's a large percentage of the United States and the world food comes from California. It's amazing.
So how did you come here then? You just got a call from John Tucker or no? It was you, Becky?
Yeah.
I see you raising your hand. Tears.
When we met when we first got together, I just said, I'm just warning you, I'm going back to New York because I lived out here for many years.
You were working at Campanelli too?
Yeah.
What were you doing?
I just went in for a trail. I was just trailing around and someone didn't show up one day. And Mark asked me if I could just like stay and work the saute station. And I did on a Friday night for free. Mm-hmm. And then he just hired me.
Oh, wow. Right place at the right time.
Yeah.
So you guys were working in the kitchen together for a while.
Yeah, I was sous chef at the time, and
you got along. So you must run a calm kitchen, because were you screaming? If you were screaming all the time, you wouldn't have wanted to go out with them,
right? No, I don't.
Things were stressful.
It's much more calm than I guess.
I don't get me wrong. I can be a huge a hole.
Yeah.
In the kitchen to the people.
Servers.
Front of the house. Sorry. Servers. Is that like saying Voldemort or something?
Yeah. But, she and I worked together side by side. There was a time when I became chef de cuisine, we literally were not apart for any more than probably an hour.
A day?
Like 3 years. Yeah, every day. We lived together, we worked together, and when I say we worked together, we worked this close to each other. I was on the grill, and she was doing, we called it bus, but it was basically entremet, which is... You do all the vegetables, and you call out tickets to the rest of the line. So they call it the bus driver.
Uh-huh.
But we did that 5 nights a week and worked every day together and then lived together.
Wow.
We work together now at Rosewater,
although I'm
in front of the house right now.
I actually did. I was married once, and I spent all my waking hours with my first wife. That actually can work in a weird way. It's like shooting the moon. It's like if you just work together in the same office and you're but if you're like mano a mano working, you're spending all your time together, like I can see that working because you're just like our comets are flying right together, and it's just like easy to think of it that way.
Yeah.
But so you were together all the time. When did you guys move into with each other? Like after living, after working together for a week or so, a month or?
It was close. 2 years, I guess.
Nah, it wasn't even that long.
No, it was about 6 months.
It was like 6 months. 6 months. Yeah.
And then after the first time you guys had sex and then you come back to Campanelli and you're right there, did that change anything?
Our relationship was a secret we got engaged. Yeah.
Yeah. Like we were pretty much living 5 blocks from the restaurant together. Uh-huh. And the only one that knew was my sous chef. who sort of made it like, no, yeah, like he was matchmaker in a way, but
the staff knew.
Yeah. You're like, you're a bunch of morons, Becky. You're doing great.
Yeah. No, it wasn't even like that. I mean, we still, you know, you have to. It's not even like, you know, she likes to say, well, one hat goes on, the other hat comes off. Like, when you go to work, you're one, and when you go home, we're another. So that's
how it had to be. Do you guys not talk about work, or do you guys...
I wish, but no, it doesn't.
We'll fight.
No, yeah, we'll fight. We fight.
So that's impressive. And now you guys are finally going to work a few blocks apart from each other, but on a collaborative effort. So that's kind of
exactly.
Cool.
Yeah.
Are you excited? Is this the first place you will own?
Yeah.
Yes, it's the first place I will own. We have two partners, Mike and Justina. Hello. But they're, you know, they started working with, we had worked with them at Rosewater. Well, not Mike, but Justina. So when she found this place, we started doing the Sandy stuff together.
Okay.
And we were like, you know, we were actually working really well together. So when the idea sort of came about, like, we should, you know, do this professionally.
Let's do this, but with booze.
With booze. Yes. It sounds great. Let's feed a lot of people with booze because it's a lot more fun that way.
Yeah.
So we did.
And who's going to be the bartender? Do you know the guy running the whole front?
Probably Justina.
Yeah.
And I'll be in the back.
Yeah, maybe Mike.
But, and what's the food concept going to be?
We're doing it's going to be farm to table bar food. It's sort of, we're calling it New American Bar Food. It's sort of, you know, gastropub sounds dumb to me. Mm-hmm. Gastro bar, I guess is what we're going to call it. But it's going to be the same thing. It's going to change all the time. And it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be chicken wings and whatever. It's actually
but
going
it could
to
be.
Yeah,
but it could be. And it's going
radishes
to be baskets.
With salt and bread and butter.
And we're doing everything. I mean, if you are eating the hamburger, I ground the meat. She made the bun. It's going to be, you know, if you're going to have a burger, it's going to be burger. But
that's interesting. Well, no, it's definitely sound there's going to be a lot of love in that kitchen.
Yeah.
And but you're still going to remain at Rosewater.
Yeah, I'll be the chef at Rosewater. I don't like to sleep.
It's well, fine. John is very happy, I'm sure, that he's not losing you because you've been with them for how many years now?
This is fourth year. Now he's been really supportive of it. So.
And the community there, Park Slope, you like cooking for those guys?
You know, it's a lot like cooking for Los Angeles.
I was going to say, it was just as you started saying that.
Yeah. No, I do. I do like cooking for Park Slope people. There. You know, they get a little pretentious flack every once in a while, but it's cool.
Lots of regular customers.
We have lots of regulars. Yeah. We do. They're good people.
Well, if you've been around 13 years, it's like, you know, it's funny. I find Park Slope annoying, but I find like Al Tila lovely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, or you know, you can go into Franny's and eat an excellent pizza.
I would say, I mean, most people are tolerant of the no stroller policy, which is good.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
God, but I also see mothers like changing their kids on the avenue. I'm like, get a hold of yourself.
Right.
This is not okay.
Yeah.
But no. I do like very much that you guys came in, and I'm happy you talked now, especially that I know exactly how connected. It would be like having Siamese twins in and only one of them talk. The other one would be like, yo, what the hell? So I really thank you guys. I recommend that people see this kind of New York, Brooklyn institution, and also to we'll have you back when the place finally opens.
Hey,
either
you
on
know
my
the name?
Show. Oh yeah, sorry, I didn't even ask.
Should I have her explain it?
Yeah, explain the name. I didn't even think it was to be asked yet.
So if you think of it in again, it's keeping the local theme in mind, the East Coast sort of mentality, the name of the place is Jeet Jet. And if you say it slow,
it's gonna be hard to find on the internet.
It's J apostrophe E E T J E T with a question mark. Jeet Jet.
You're sitting around having a pitcher of beer.
Jeet Jet.
Getting hungry. Jeet Jet.
Oh, I see.
Jeet Jet.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. Good. Good. Jeet
Jet. Jeet Jet.
It will be hard to Google, though. You will have to make maybe.
That's a good point.
Jeet Jet. It should maybe a tagline because the main, I don't know, Jeet Jet, J apostrophe E-E-T.
Yeah, it's like
E-A-T.
A Jeet.
Then no, then it J apostrophe E E T J E T question mark.
Oh man. Woo. Well, I wish you all the local business as possible because no one else is gonna find you. No, just kidding. That's a joke. But I do very much thank you. You guys are lovely, and you guys should come back on my show, on other shows. We will follow your progress as you guys grow your restaurant Tetoir instead of Terroir, Tet French terroir in the industry.
We'd love to come back.
Yeah, you should. And we have a lot of great shows. Remember, for all our listeners, that means we're a membership-based organization. And if we can get his phone, his Omaha phone, to work, we're going to talk to one of our favorite guests. He's the Marv Albert of the station. And he is going to talk all about the waning culture, the changing and waning culture of our truckers on the roads around the U.S. So stay tuned, and we will be back in 60 seconds.
You're listening to This Body by Pamela Royal on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
All right, we are back. Larry, are you with us?
Yeah, good afternoon, Patrick. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thanks so much for being on with us again.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
I say you're like the Marv Albert for David Letterman. Whenever, you know, he was like, oh, I want to, you know, get a good session in, he would call Marv Albert. And so Marv Albert, I think, has been on Dave Letterman like 500 times. But
he brings the bloopers in the blips of sports, I believe.
Yes, exactly. So now Larry basically is the puppet master. You know, he runs the logistics of Cannonball Express, which is a less-than-load trucking carrier. Their entire force runs everything from Omaha East, and their partner business called C.H. Robinson runs everything for them from Omaha West. Is that right, Larry?
That's correct.
And so there is a real culture of the trucker that you are connected to. And, you know, we were just talking with our last guest about Smokey and the Bandit and Burt Reynolds and Breaker Breaker, the Chuck Norris film, and Convoy, the amazing song. I mean, trucking is really a part of our culture. And yet that culture is changing in many ways. And one of the big reasons why, for instance, is loss of CB radio culture and CB lingo. So could you speak a little bit about the role of the CB device in the truck and how it's changed over the past few decades?
Right. Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, back 10, 15, 20 years ago, the only communication was with the CB radio, and that's how trucks communicated with law enforcement, with truck stops ahead. They checked with other drivers asking about road conditions, and pretty much it was a safety device, but also a communication device to talk and visit with friends and family along the road as they made their way across the highways of America.
Did
and
it
now
keep
with the cell phones implementation, it's pretty much CB still exists, but cell phones are generally speaking the way they communicate for safety, for radar devices to check weather and traffic and construction areas.
So it's you can only talk to one person on the cell phone. So it's gone from a group conversation to just one-on-one, basically.
Yeah, it used to be, and it still is, CBs are a way to talk to multiple drivers that are driving. You could pass a truck and see one coming in the opposite direction, and you could call that driver on the CB and get instant conversation with that truck. Cell phones, obviously, not able to do that unless you know the phone number, so cell phones are mainly used now for communication from dispatch and for safety, for weather-related issues and questions about road conditions. But generally speaking, all cell phone usage is limited, at least in my business, to when the trucks are stationary. So they pull over and ask for information, go to truck stops and make calls, and the CB is still used on the road for general communications because we don't want the hazards of cell phone use to interfere with safety of trucking.
Yeah, for sure. And what was the range of the CB radio? I mean, how many miles could you be from other truckers and still converse with them?
Yeah, generally, 30 or 40 miles was pretty normal. You could get good communication. Plus, law enforcement would monitor CB stations, so you could get instant access if you had an emergency to notify law enforcement. So 30, 40 miles, you could talk an hour almost to anybody that you were communicating with along the road.
Very interesting. Now, are there fewer convoys because of lack of CB radio culture, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, convoys were fun and interesting. I would say there aren't as many this time, this present time compared to the olden days. But a lot of truckers weren't hurried in the olden days, so they would buddy up. They would wait at truck stops for 2, 3, 4, 10 other trucks, and they'd run across the country together as a group. Now, once you're loaded, you have a limited culture on how many hours and times you can drive and sleep, and you have destinations and appointments to make. So you really can't sit for hours and waste your time waiting for a lot of trucks to join in. But convoys are still utilized. If you're out on the highway and you meet up with other trucks driving in your direction, you can produce a convoy and use the CB just as the old days. They always called the trucks in the middle of the convoy rocking chairs. If you were in the middle of a convoy, not the front truck or the back truck, you were considered in the rocking chair position. Huh. And that was always fun lingo, like you mentioned, the Smokey and the Bandit thing. There are a lot of different slang words that were used in those days that are still used today.
Very, very interesting. And now, and what about the leader of the convoy? Was he always a set mile per hour over or under the speed limit?
Yeah, he was the sitting duck. They call him the sitting duck, the lead truck that would take the risk of setting the speed for the convoy. And you would always communicate with the trucks in the opposite direction and know if there was a bear in the air or a bear in the woods, Smokey the Bear. And then, the eyes and ears of the CB was everybody was looking out for everybody to make sure they had a safe journey. Maybe sometimes slightly over the speed limit, but that certainly wasn't the goal of the CB radio. It was to keep camaraderie and safety on hand so they could communicate along the road.
Now, was it made illegal to flip your lights to alert someone to a bear?
I don't believe it's illegal, but the law enforcement frowns on that. They'd rather, if they're hid in the woods, they certainly don't want people telling on them where they're at. But there are a lot of things you would do to make sure the other motorists knew of where speed traps were and where speed limits went up or down so you would monitor your speeds and stay legal.
Now, tell us about the Montfort lane.
Well, the Montfort lane goes back to the beef industry back in Colorado. There's a meatpacking company called Montfort, and a lot of their trucks would buddy up together, and when they got on the road, they always ran the left lane, and when you're out on the traffic lane, you know slower vehicles move to the right, and the left lane's headed is basically reserved for faster traffic. Those Montfort lane was produced by the Montfort trucks running always in that left lane together in a convoy-type situation. And even today, people from that age, along with I, understand that you always call the left lane the Montfort lane. It's just a tradition, and that's where the name came from.
Very interesting. That's funny. Are they still around, I wonder?
Montfort is now part of, I was in the meat industry for 25 years. Names have changed, but Montfort merged with companies, and now you've got, the Swift and Company, right. The Armor Companies, the Wilsons, the Cudahys. They've all changed names, and Montfort is just one of those, all kind of joined in with other meatpacking names. So, yes, they're all around, but they don't necessarily go by the Montfort name anymore.
Well, now I have two more questions for you this go around. One is related to the issue that you talked about last time you were on and a couple times, I think, before that. There is now a rule that states that a driver can only drive 11 hours out of every 14, right? I mean, well, just give us the stats again so I don't get them wrong. And I have a question. Absolutely. Following up.
Okay. Yeah, that's correct. you can only drive for a total of 11 hours before you're required to take a minimum of 10-hour sleeper berth. Now, you can drive a maximum of 11 hours in a 14-hour period. So let's say you stop for an hour to get fuel or stop to dine. You can work and drive for 14 hours, but you cannot drive more than 11 hours of that 14. Then you're required to take a 10-hour sleeper berth.
Now, that made sense to me because I was like, wow, these truckers, they're on the road. They shouldn't be driving for 20 straight hours. There should be laws. I mean, imagine if a trucker falls asleep and it could hurt people. And that was my instinct. And then talking to you, you kind of complicated it. I mean, along with the fact that truckers' pay and salary hasn't gone up as much, plus the fact that they now have to drive faster on the same fastest going highways, I mean, it has not been a complete move toward safety because other safety issues have come up as a result of this rule, right?
Well, in a way, but the speed limits that are on the highways, in some states, trucks are actually limited to less speed limits than private vehicles. If you're traveling on a highway, sometimes like in Illinois, trucks are mandated they can only exceed 55 mile an hour while other vehicles do 65. I call that somewhat of a hazard because you're actually in a position when you try to go uphill with a truck and you're losing speed and you've got vehicles that are going 10 miles an hour legally over your allowed speed, I believe that becomes an issue. But generally speaking, if you're driving 11 hours and you're averaging 60 miles an hour, you can only work and travel 660 miles a day. Mm-hmm. So that controls the revenue and the distance you can travel. So nowadays versus the old culture that we were kind of talking about earlier, trucks are their main objective is to get to point A to point B. They don't have time to stop for a stranded motorist or be neighborly or just put their elbow out the window and cruise down the highway below the speed limit, because that cuts into their revenue opportunity. So trucks in general, you want to maintain the maximum speed limit but not go over and get to your point of destination as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. You don't have time to lollygag and diddle-daddle along the highway as it used to be in the earlier days where a lot of the highways were single-lane highways and you'd come up a motorist. Back those days, the truckers were your best friend. They'd stop for anybody at any time. Mm-hmm. Now you're motivated. You got to be where you got to be based on the revenues.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, my last question, since, I know trucking, of course, every piece of food, and for that matter, anything that you can look at, if you're listening, look around, everything that you can look at has been on a truck. In fact, just it's a challenge. You can try to find something in your house that's not been on a truck. But so obviously that's a big part of food. But to bring this into food, has the diner culture changed, Larry? I mean, with the kind of changing of the trucking scene, are there fewer famous diners around the country, or is that a tough question for you? Because I know you're based primarily out of Omaha.
Diners, do you mean truck stop diners?
Yes.
Are you talking about mom and pop?
Yeah, truck stop.
Generally speaking, yeah. Truckers don't necessarily, I mean, they still eat at the diners that are located in truck stops, but with the sophistication and the way that trucks and trailers travel, our units are decked out with satellite TVs, and we have microwaves, and a lot of my drivers, because they can't afford to stop for an hour and dine out, because they have to keep moving based on the laws of the road, mm-hmm. they pack their lunches, and they're pretty much taking their lunch boxes to work with them. They don't do a lot of sitting in truck stops and having steak dinners for an hour and a half on their voyages.
Fascinating. I love it.
Come more, I think the truck stops in general now cater to both the trucker and the traveler. So I think, if you're out on the road in your family in your station wagon, you're more comfortable stopping at truck stops nowadays because there are a lot of four-wheelers there, not just 18-wheelers.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yeah, they've lost a little bit of that. Well, very, very interesting. I mean, I find this the most fascinating American lore, that you bring to us in the station. And so we're always honored for you to be a guest. And thanks for what you do for small businesses everywhere through your less-than-load company, Cannonball Express.
That sounds great. I'll give you a couple of tests there, Patrick. You got a second?
Yeah, fire away.
Okay, what's a suicide jockey?
Suicide jockey is the first one to go over a bridge when it's ice on the roads?
It's a driver of a gas tanker.
Oh.
A tractor trailer calling gas.
Oh.
A mobile parking lot is an automotive car carrier.
A mobile parking lot.
Go ahead.
No, I was laughing at that.
Oh, yeah. And a popsicle stick is your mile marker when you're going along the interstates. The mile marker, every 1 mile, you see the green number of the mile marker. That's called the popsicle stick back in those days. So
popsicle stick.
My wife wanted to make sure that you understood what suicide jockey was. So you failed on that one. But
I know.
In mind from now on.
I'm out. Try to tell her. We'll re-edit the show once we're done, and I'll get it right on the second go around.
That's cheating.
Just kidding. Well, no, it'll stay forever as is. Well, Larry, thanks for everything. Hey, thanks to our listeners.
Welcome.
Thanks to Joe, and we will see you next week on The Main Course.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.